The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis and today's show is a Mercury Prize special.
Of the 2009 Barclay Card Mercury Prize is Speech DeBell!
Yes, that was Speech DeBell, remember her, winning last year's award. And coming up today, we'll be hearing interviews from many of this year's nominees, including the XX and I Am Clute.
It's all very well to everyone get excited about prizes and contests and everything. It seems as if this is what I've been striving to do my whole life, win the Mercury Prize. And it, unfortunately, it isn't.
We'll be discussing the runners and riders in full and giving our own views on who deserves to be the 2010 winner. That's all in Music Weekly. Right, joining me for bumper Mercury chat today, it's Rosie Swash. Hello, Rosie. Welcome
Hello.
Back.
Thank you very much.
You well?
I'm very well.
Excellent. I'm pleased to hear it. The editor of The Guardian's film and music supplement, Michael Han, is also here.
Hello, Alexis.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And we've got a fourth panellist for this special Mercury podcast. Acting arts editor, Alex Needham, is with us. How are you, Alex?
I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. Everybody's very good. Right, we've got a lot to cram into today's podcast, so we shall move straight on. The Mercury Prize is, of course, the annual music awards ceremony. It's held on Tuesday night. This coming Tuesday night, obviously, it's not held every Tuesday night. That would be ridiculous. In which a selected panel from the music industry and the media decide on the best album from the past year. There are 12 names on the shortlist for us to mull over. Let's start out with Cumbria's finest, Wild Beasts. We'll hear Rosie having a quick chat with them about their album shortly. But first, here's the title track, Two Dancers.
To ask you something that you'd said about the drumming, the drumming has been central to the album, which is not a surprising statement having listened to the album, but I just wondered if you could expand on what you meant.
I've talked about the eternal recurrence, which is a theme of the album, like with the dancing, this like kind of relentless movement and these things progressing without you, and we wanted it to sound as if like our hands we weren't in control of what we were doing, if you know what I mean, as if some force was propelling us. So that's one concession this time. We did everything very tight, click tracks, to make it very efficient, I suppose.
It's quite a violent album, the impact here.
Yeah, I mean, it's about those unhinged emotions, you know, when you're in those states of high emotion and extreme happiness and extreme anger very close together. But I think, in a way, pop should be a Trojan horse. It should have the facade of something which is quite welcoming, and you want to let it in, and it's, you know, it's got melody and it's got you know, nice sounds, but as well there should be a hell of a lot in the belly that when you listen to it 10-15 times you should work something else out, and then suddenly it's clicked, there's something else in there, you know, and that's our vision of pop, I think.
How much do you take on board any criticism that you get, because this album has had completely divisive, just complete polar opposites of reactions.
It's important to take risks, and it's important to almost make mistakes in a way, and it's rare that people are allowed to do that in modern music, and that's a real shame, you know. I mean, surely that's what young bands are supposed to do, is to take risks and to make the old guys look old, to push them out of the way and say, look, we're sick of this sort of predictable, safe music, and we're going to, you know, confront you here and make you choose. You know, if you want to really, really please someone, you're going to have to annoy someone.
And that someone is me. that was Rosie talking to Hayden and Ben from Wild Beast. Rosie, not my cup of tea. You are a huge fan.
I am indeed.
You've been championing them for a while. Are they your choice? They're your pick to win?
They are. I still love this album. I still find something new in it that I listen to. Every time I listen to it, I find it very beautiful and powerful and masculine without being macho, and regardless of what you may think, quite an unpretentious album. Me, you're going to do that.
I think they could
benefit very well from the exposure. I'm sure they already have.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, yeah.
I would imagine they've got a good chance.
Yeah, I think they probably have a good chance. Well, Alex, your feelings upon the Wild Beasts?
Well, I think that the kind of thing they do is maybe slipping into focus a bit more in this kind of second half of the year. I think there's been a sort of, well, not an explosion, but definitely music that's a bit more kind of ambitious, almost like the Janelle Monáe album, you know, and her working with Of Montreal, this and Dirty Projectors last year, but also who've been around quite a lot this year. I just think that's sort of more arty, slightly, you know, music that's not afraid to be slightly ridiculous. I think it's that people are getting used to it, and I think this is an album that you do sort of get used to and then get into. You know, you have got to kind of get over the factor that it is slightly ridiculous and makes you laugh at times.
Michael, are you don't strike me as the kind of man that would like Wild Beasts.
I'm a very flamboyant man, Alexis.
Yes, you look very flamboyant.
Listening to the interview...
Is that by Bernard Wilhelm?
Listening to the interview, I'm talking about the need to make music that challenges and kicks away the old people. Well, their music doesn't do that. It's all about Hayden Thorpe's voice. The music, it's nice enough, but there's nothing tremendously dramatic or excitement musically about them. It all comes down to what you feel about Hayden Thorpe's voice. And as they say, trying to make everything seem hysterically emotional, emotionally unhinged.
I don't think it all comes down to his voice. Tom Fleming sings as much on this as Hayden does.
I actually prefer the songs that he sings.
Yeah, and they've both got baritone and falsetto voices. And I think there's a lot going on there, but people get totally put off by Hayden's voice, which I can understand. I think it's like what Alex said, you've got to kind of get over that.
But coming down to what they're saying about emotionally unhinged, well, I don't look for emotionally unhinged in music very much. I like quite emotional hingedness. I like to be able to see the hinges screwed into the door frame of the music so I can connect it to some kind of real life. And, you know, Wild Beasts, it's not that they sound too imaginative. They just sound like they're coming from someplace I have no conception of. You know, it just... in the words of an indie hero of a previous generation, it says nothing to me about my life.
So you don't like emotionally unhinged music. Moving from emotionally unhinged music to bonkers. Yeah, yes.
Whoa.
Oh, brilliant. This is pure gold, this, ladies and gentlemen, pure gold. Let's move on to the next album, which is Tongue in Cheek from the past winner, Dizzy Rascal. That was Holiday from Dizzy Rascal's album Tongue in Cheek. I don't think this can possibly win on the grounds that they've already given Dizzy Rascal a Mercury Prize for a record that...
was much better.
Well, it's not necessarily better, but whichever way you slice it, it's a much more adventurous and challenging record. Would anybody like to contradict me?
What?
You all would, come on. Alex first.
Well, you could argue that what he's done in becoming a mainstream pop star is possibly more radical than being a kind of niche guy out on the margins, of which there are loads. I mean, he's sort of brought, you know, he's changed the music, but I don't think he's necessarily diluted what he stands for. And I think to put yourself right in the centre of something, it's the kind of thing that used to happen in the early 80s, isn't it? Where you'd have people who'd been doing fairly marginal music, you know, like the Human League, suddenly decided to have number one hits. And I always think there's something quite invigorating about that for pop.
I think also the Mercury judges talk about how the purpose of the prize is to reward, you know, an album that reflects where British music is and the direction it's going in. And I think unarguably the trend over the last year has been the move of grime and dubstep, well, not so much, but grime MCs into the mainstream by going in a pop direction. I mean, this reflects that completely.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be the M People winner of this year, though I suspect Dizzy Rascal wouldn't welcome the comparison. But yeah, I mean, one would like a bit more bonkersness about it. I remember when he did Bonkers on Jules Holland, I thought it was the single greatest TV moment of the last couple of years. It was just unhinged, emotionally unhinged. Yeah. In a way, the Wild Beasts unhinged. Don't really manage for me. But yes, I take your point about the album.
Rosie?
I do find it a spectacularly garish album that I can't, you know,
it's not meant to be, though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you do compare it to Boy in the Corner from, was that 2003?
2000 and...
It was some years ago.
Seven years ago. Yeah. You know, and I agree with Alex's point that it has done something, it has opened a lot of doors, and it certainly deserves to to get some plaudit for that, but I think it should be an armful of Brits rather than a Mercury.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely, I would completely agree with that. More of a Brits winner. Less of a Brits winner, one would imagine, the Kit Downs Trio. Every year a jazz album gets, you have to say it's a token nod. This is no disrespect whatsoever to the world of jazz. Makes a shortlist this year, 2010, no different. Kit Downs Trio's album Golden is the winner this year, or not the winner, certainly not the winner. It's been nominated. Let's hear now from the trio, not just Kit Downs, but Callum Gourley and James Madron as well.
Being nominated for the Mercury was a big surprise, I guess.
Yeah.
A nice surprise, but not by any means expected. I wasn't totally sure what the Mercury was about until I realised we were in it.
I knew about it, but I didn't quite know ever what it involved, you know.
Yeah, I think it's more of a pop thing. I think there's jazz in it every year, but I guess it's made a fairly big difference, like, in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, for a start, that first day when we were nominated,
that was a pretty different experience.
It was, yeah. Going to the hospital club and just that massive line of cameras and interviewers, and
yeah, we're kind of used to like 50 people at the 606, not loads of press, but it was it's nice, it's fun. But I mean, at the same time, it's not like we made this album to win a prize or anything.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not too bothered if we win or not, I suppose. It's just kind of being involved.
I have to say, I'm not expecting to win.
Okay, James isn't expecting
to win.
Look
at the odds. Well, I think we should put money on that.
So Time Out put our odds at 100,000 million to one.
Are you serious?
No. I'm going to definitely put
at
least
worth
a quid
on
it.
That's obviously
put my weekly pocket money on that.
But yeah, I guess every year there is a kind of, there is always a jazz thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess people call that a token jazz act.
Well, I think someone put it well the other day, I can't remember who said it, but in the past it's been kind of the more rocky, fusion-y, punky
crossover
areas
jazz.
Of jazz,
right,
and yeah. I kind of think of Golden as a jazz album, even though it's like every other thing, you know, it's a big mishmash of lots of different things. I kind of think of it as jazz, definitely.
Yeah.
I think it's because it's quite a traditional lineup, piano, bass, drums, and there's a lot of improvising in it.
And it's all acoustic.
Yeah, it's cool that it's there. You know, it's very different to any of the other music that's on there. But, I mean, it's cool being the jazz name on the list. Yeah. I think it's really hip that the Mercury still acknowledge that the UK has such a great jazz scene.
Yeah.
It's really important that it's acknowledged and that it's not totally run by this kind of pop music industry.
There is music outside that.
I think the thing about jazz is it's, as a genre, it's not got a specific sound. It's not like maybe indie, which has a quite specific sound to it. I mean, obviously there are different types within it, but jazz is so different. You know, you can pick five bands from Britain and they're all sound completely different. Like, you know, really crazy electronica kind of improv, to really quiet acoustic free improv, to kind of the rock side of jazz, to the really acoustic side of jazz, to the folk side of jazz. It's like endless subgenres within it. So the idea of there being this kind of staple jazz fan is a myth, really, because people are just into what they're into.
Oh, the Kit Downs Trio there. Now, say what you like about it being tokenist, putting a jazz thing in. It actually does, I know for a fact, because Courtney Pine told me this, do a lot of good for jazz acts, because unbelievably, your average sale on a British jazz album is about 3,000 copies. 5,000 is like, my God, you're a phenomenon. You know what I mean? I don't mean to Jamie Coleman, people like that. So actually, you know, it's one area where the Mercury really comes into its own, in that these records will sell a little bit more. Is it time they gave it to a jazz act?
Well,
Michael?
No, they're never going to. But and also the jury isn't, with all due respect to the jury, is not filled with jazz experts. I mean, this is the problem, actually, with... Great, one act benefits each year from the Mercury nomination. But what about the countless other acts that see nothing from it? The process that results in this. I'll be honest, none of us around this table have any idea whether the Kit Downs Trio was the best jazz record released in the UK in last year.
Speak for yourself.
Okay, Alex does. You know, but I can't help thinking about all the other acts that haven't made it. It would seem fairer almost to cut them out and find some way of rewarding jazz properly.
But, you know, I don't know, maybe do that.
Well, maybe you do a Mercury, you divide the Mercury up so you have a Mercury pop prize of 6 albums and a Mercury jazz prize of 6 albums. I remember with classical, they had classical in the mix for about the first 5 or 6 years, didn't they?
Yeah.
But there was only one judge who ever voted for that. I know that was my wife's ex-flatmate.
Right.
She was the one charged with nominating the classical album each year. I mean, it's a miserable process. Yeah. I actually think it reflects badly on the Mercury's, not well.
Alex?
I mean, I think in a way, there's slightly more crossover with the token classical one than there would be with the token jazz one. I don't know whether maybe I'm wrong, but I think that if you're into sort of more kind of alternative music, it would sort of intersect with classical at one point, whereas this kind of more traditional jazz, I don't know. But having said that, you know, it's meant to represent the new music being made at the moment, which includes jazz, but they've never managed to square.
But if it does truly represent that, how come there's only one jazz album each year that's been good enough to get on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a sort of misnomer there that you can judge utterly different, not different genres of music, but just whole different worlds of music by the same criteria. And, you know, I spoke to sort of jazz critics about it, I spoke to classical critics about it, and they all agreed, no, you can't. The criteria by which one judges, you know, Mumford and Sons is not the same criteria by which one judges Stockhausen. You know, I don't know, that's that radical a suggestion. But, you know, Rosie, what do you...
Well, I, of course, you know, had never heard of the Kitsan Trio and was pulled up on it by referring to them in the captions to the Mercury Gallery as the token jazz nomination, despite the fact that that's how they just referred to themselves. But I spoke to John Fordham, our jazz reviewer, about it, and he's adamant that this is the right choice and that they are not necessarily the most pioneering jazz acts of the last 12 months, but certainly, you know, of what degree the hype canon has. You know, the jazz canon has hype and buzz around it. This is the band for them. So, you know, maybe it is the right choice in that regard, and possibly classical just doesn't need that boost that jazz does.
I mean, I suppose the feeling is that, you know, if you're sufficiently intrigued to check out this jazz album, then maybe you might get into jazz through that go further into the scene. Whether anyone has ever actually done that, I'm not sure. Maybe someone can leave a comment
I bet someone has. Well, okay, that's Kit Downs' trail. We don't really fancy their chances, but you never know. Anyway, next up it's Mumford and Sons. So tie me to a post. That's Sigh No More from the album The Cave by Mumford & Sons, the sleeper hit of the summer, this album, very clearly. People really love it. I think it's interesting in that there seems to be a sort of a critical backlash against them now. I can sort of see why. I think they probably stand quite a good chance of winning just because there's a bit of motion behind them. Michael, is this your cup of tea?
Not really, no. I reviewed the album for Film & Music when it came out, and it was one because I'd heard good word of mouth about them from people I like and whose judgment I often trust. And it really, really underwhelmed me.
Mm. People say you got to see them live.
Well, that's what I hear, and I never have, except on the television at those festivals where I'm always put off by the fact they're dressed like extras from Lark Rise to Candleford. But, yeah, it sold 1 million copies, which is staggering. I was out the other night with Stephen Adams, who used to be in the Broken Family Band, who was telling me that a couple of years ago when Mumford & Sons came through, and the Broken Family Band had just stopped playing that kind of English country thing they did. He said, oh, these people come up to me and say, oh, we used to really like you, but now we've switched over to Mumford & Sons, you know. Maybe if you carried on, we'd carry on liking you. And he reflected that he couldn't really imagine that even if they had carried on selling Playing Country, that the Broken Family Band would have sold a million records this year.
No, no, no.
Didn't seem likely. But you know, they I don't know what nerve it is they touch with people, but clearly they do. I mean, you see the festival footage and people look euphoric watching them. It's astounding.
I think it's because, it, aside from this kind of parochial, you know, 19th century outfits and the Dust Bowl themes and all that, there is such a hyper emotion to their music that it's kind of like what Coldplay do.
Or the Arcade Fire.
I don't think it's that different. I just think it's in a slightly different genre. So I think you need to remotely be into folk to be swept up in it.
No, I agree. I don't think it's folk music at all, really. But do they have that same kind of yearning and vague, non-specific melancholy but slightly uplifting thing that's what Coldplay are all about?
I think that's what people like, though, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Do you get that from... Because I don't really quite get that from them, but obviously some people do.
Well, I think they just have a surging anthemic thing that will always be popular, whether it's, you know, whether it's Oasis doing it, Coldplay, or, you know, a big kind of dance record. I did see them live at Glastonbury in the John Peel tent, which was oversubscribed by loads, although I got there quite early. Not quite sure why, but they were.
You love them.
But they were. Well, I mean, I did think they were really good. I mean, it's not my cup of tea generally, but you know, they have really rousing tunes. It's as simple as that, and they do put on quite a show. I mean, instrument swapping doesn't sound too exciting on paper, but you know, they all do everything, and it's very kind of involving.
People like that as well. That's Arcade Fire, you know what I mean? Yeah. Again, a similar kind of thing. I reckon they've got quite a good chance of winning. Yeah. Let's move on.
Although that critical backlash might prevent them from that, I think.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know.
I don't think critics matter that much, do they?
But well, the fact they're voting for it.
Because that's who's on the panel.
Yeah, but they'll want to prove they're contrary and not swayed by the opinions of critics.
that's true.
Let's move on to I Am Clue. I think one of the more surprising nominations this year. Rosie spoke to singer John Bramwell about the Mercury Prize. But first, let's listen to Northern Skies from the album Sky at Night. Some people think stars rule our lives. Some people, they think otherwise. What does anybody know? Where shall I go on that big black night? Shall I take the coast road back through my life? See the sand, the moon, the stars that shine the light and say, well, they'll do all right.
My first question is about the reaction to the album in general leading up to the Mercury nomination, because there was definitely a feeling that this was something special from you guys, and I just wondered whether you felt that yourselves.
Well, I'd like to thank the Guardian podcast people for being the first people to point that out ever since this furore over the Mercury. Yeah, I think the album has been really well received already. Which in a way I think has been slightly overshadowed, I think, by this Mercury nomination. In all the times that I've been writing and performing, which is a long time now, and especially with I Am Clue, because I Am Clue is the first thing I've done in my life where it really came to fruition, what we're trying to do is communicate something that I find difficult to communicate in any other way other than like in music and song and singing and performing. And it's all very well to everyone get excited about prizes and contests and everything. It seems as if this is what I've been striving to do my whole life, win the Mercury Prize.
And it's not.
And unfortunately, it isn't now. I do think that... Because, you know, it does feel like you're putting your head over the parapets to get shot at whenever you release the record on LP. And I was just amazed by the reception. I think, it's particularly in the UK, I think we've always had great reception from the media and audiences all over Europe, and we've built up a good following in the UK, but I don't think we've ever been media friendly or something. I don't know. I know that I can speak for you, Rosie. You would have been speaking to me anyway, regardless of the Mercury.
Well, probably not for a Mercury special, but that might be a bit strange.
Oh, no. What do
they need? Dave Simpson, in reviewing your album for The Guardian, I think it was the week before release, he quoted a couple of lines and said that they're an example of why this record felt like you were stumbling from life's last chance saloon. Oh, you know, would you say that's a reflection of where you were at when you wrote this record?
I don't think I mean, it's obvious in a lot of my songs, my personal life has been quite turbulent. It's not. I mean, no, not really, way more than necessarily anybody else's is. I don't necessarily. Yeah, I think I know exactly what he means there. I think the interpretation on that could be that it's my career, in inverted commas, that is stumbling or falling out of a bar. Yeah, it isn't really. It's my relationships with other human beings that is stumbling and falling out of bars. The relationships, not me. And and that's the kind of thing I do write about. Yeah, even when as I said before, this is quite a, I think, a gentle and positive record. But yeah, on a song called To the Brink, it's about going to the brink in a bar that's called The Brink. Yeah, things fall apart occasionally. I don't think it's particularly, it's not death metal, I'm going to kill your grandmother. Although the next album could have a bit of that in it.
That's Rosie talking to John Bramwell from I Am Clute. Rainwashed Northern Melancholia tends to play quite well with the Mercurys, doesn't it? I mean, obviously Elbow won a couple of years back. Richard Hawley, did his career, received a huge boost through his nomination for the Mercury Prize. What do we make of I Am Clute, Rosie?
Well, I think this album, the response to this album, shares a lot with Corin Bailey-Rae's nomination, because I think it's as much about the journey as the music itself. Because there's been a lot of talk of, you know, the idea that I Am Clute are, or particularly John Bramwell, is something of an underdog. He's had quite a difficult life. There's a fragility to the songwriting, and I think Dave's mentioned something which does stand out, which is that it's the songwriter's first understanding of mortality, and that's what you get on the album. And I think you need to know a little bit more about what's happened to I Am Clute and the kind of disastrous industry issues they've had to feel that kind of sympathy for them and to understand where it's coming from. Because I think there's a couple of songs in there which I love, particularly one called Radiation, which I find very moving, but it doesn't pack that much of an emotional punch for me, because I've never really followed them as a band. But their fans going absolutely ape for this album.
I was thinking there's a wider than the fans going absolutely ape for it. I was really startled. You know, there's a feature on Front Row on Radio 4 about them, which seemed just a, you know, really unexpected thing to happen. Alex, you look baffled.
Well, there has been a lot of Northern Melancholia around, but I just don't know whether another tear-stained album, you know, hunched over a pint of mild at 2 in the morning, is really adding anything to the sum of sort of human enjoyment, really.
I think you could have said the summer of love. I just lived through the summer of love without realising it. Yeah, maybe. This all brings me to something that I hadn't thought of. Where's True Love's Gutter by Richard Hawley in this list?
Sure. Well, that's a much better album.
That genuinely remarkable record, yeah. And should have been on this list. I totally didn't think of that. You know, yeah. Michael.
I didn't commission a review for Film and Music of this album, because it was one of those ones I thought, well, they've had umpteen albums before. No one's really taken much notice. It sounds pleasant enough, but, you know, the last one sounded pleasant enough. And lo and behold, they promptly get the Mercury nomination for an album that we didn't cover in any way, shape, or form in Film and Music.
We'll edit this out.
But it's one of those things that people say their fan base is so hysterical. You know, Dave Simpson was on the phone to me saying, "You've got to review that album. It's a great album." And yeah, I feel like I've been reading that for years and years and years about I Am Clute from people who cheer for them. I understand why they cheer for them, but kind of like Alex, there's a certain amount of northern windswept melancholia I can go for, but you know, my glass only needs to be half full for me to have enough northern windswept melancholia in my life, really.
Interesting.
I feel bad for him. I feel that this is my shortcoming rather than theirs, because it is a rather lovely album.
I wonder if it can succeed, given that Elbow won a couple of years ago. Well, we shall see. That's I Am Clute. Don't forget, you can leave any comments for us at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Let us know who you think should win and what you think about the eventual decision. We'll read out some of your views in next week's show. Still to come in this Mercury special, we've got interviews with the XX and Laura Marling. But before that, let's talk Biffy Clyro.
I talk to God as much as I talk to Satan, cause I want to hear both sides. Does that make me cynical? There are no miracles, and this is no miracle.
That was God and Satan from the album Only Revolutions by Biffy Clyro. A record that is currently, I can tell you, having been on a driving holiday around Northumberland recently, never off Radio 2. It really, who would have thought that Biffy Clyro would be on the Radio 2 playlist? What do we mean? I mean, this is music that is, it is, you know, there's some music in your life that you just know is not for you, and Biffy Clyro is just not for me. I'm sure they have many wonderful qualities as a band. It's just not my cup of tea at all. Anyone?
Well, I'm going to stick up for Biffy Clyro, not because I think they're particularly great, but because I think the Mercury shortlist routinely ignores fairly straightforward rock. And fairly straightforward rock, done well, can be an absolutely thrilling and joyful thing. And Biffy Clyro do it pretty well. I mean, I'm having to defend Biffy Clyro while actually not liking them that much. It's an opposition. But, you know, I think it's wrong to just write, oh, you know, they're musical Neanderthals, oh, it's meat and potatoes. A good steak with very good frite is a delicious dish, so you shouldn't write off meat and potatoes.
No, I wasn't writing off meat and potatoes. I like meat and pototoes as much as the next.
Let's take it outside.
What are you saying? I'm on the musical Atkins diet here. Alex, is this your...
Well, no, me neither, but it's good to see it on the Mercury Prize list because, I mean, rock music and the kind of bands that would be in Kerrang
never get anywhere near it.
So... And also, you know, they do this sort of thing that you're not meant to be able to do in this kind of quick turnaround music industry. You know, they've actually built a kind of a long career, and they've sort of progressed over a series of albums.
Rosie,
well, no, I'm not a fan either. But I, you know, as you were mentioned before, there's kind of an anthropological interest in these areas of music which you know you're never gonna delve into. Like, for example, going on holiday to Ibiza and seeing Swedish House Mafia at Pasha, which was quite a strange experience.
Was that amazing?
It wasn't amazing. It was just, you know, it's very rare that I can never identify with what a crowd is feeling. And I think, you know, quite possibly that was one of the moments.
Yeah.
What are you celebrating? I didn't even hear the drop. What are you celebrating?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the love that Biffy get means...
Mon the Biffy, as they say.
I love it.
I don't actually know what that means. What does that mean?
Come on the Biffy.
Oh, does it?
Come on, Alex. I do like it when a fan's favourite gets on these kind of lists and passes the usual critics. Mm. That always warms my heart a little bit.
I think there is a very valid point being made here that I have a mate called Dom Lawson who writes for Metal Hammer and Classic Rock and all those kind of things. And on his business card, it actually says, Dom Lawson, metalhead, also music journalist. And he would say, you know, I mean, he really does very, very strongly feel that metal is completely cut out of the equation of things like the Mercury Prize and stuff
like that. Well, Biffy Clyro on a metal band.
No, but I'm just saying this is as close as the Mercury's ever going to get.
Straight ahead rock music gets a terrifically raw deal. I think blog culture has actually kind of exacerbated that because people are looking for the cleverest, most forward-thinking, most imaginative thing. And no one's ever going to say that straight-ahead rock music is clever and forward-thinking and imaginative. But, you know, it is the building block on which everything else is based. You know, without Elvis, there's nothing. And this is music that comes in a straight line back from that. And I think we all give hard rock an unfair deal.
I think we're actually coming round to Biffy Clyro. Mon the bloggers. That's what we're saying here. Next up, something totally different. It's Villagers, who were nominated for the album Becoming a Jackal. We asked frontman Conor O'Brien his views on his Mercury nomination.
My manager called me, and I think he was probably the most excited I've ever heard him. He was like a little schoolboy. I was also excited, but perhaps not as much. I'm trying to keep my cool about it and just sort of put it all in perspective. You know, it's a prize. My main memory is the M people winning, which is which is nice for them. But I remember Arctic Monkeys winning as well because they all looked so young. I remember seeing them go up and get their prize. And I mean, I knew about it and everything. We've got a thing in Ireland called the Choice Music Prize, which is kind of the Irish equivalent of it. So. I probably hear a bit more about that because it's just all over the papers in Ireland. But yeah, I'm not going to lie and say it doesn't matter. Of course it might. I mean, it would be very exciting if I won. I've also got a slight fear in the back of my mind about winning things because it makes you feel popular, and all my songs are about feeling unpopular. So. On this ship of promises. Denial. Every longing is up on trial, so you learn. I've started writing again, finally. I haven't been able to write for the last while. The last sort of few weeks, I've actually started writing songs again, which is good. So I need to keep that separate from this other thing, which is a bit more circus-like. And, you know, yeah. I don't know, I'm sort of just rolling with it all. I'm not like, I didn't predict, it wouldn't have even entered my mind, that sort of side of things. When I was writing the album, I was very much in that headspace of writing. And then when we finally released the album, I was like just super excited about being able to go out and tour. And then when we got told we were up for a prize, I was excited about that as well. I just kind of take it a bit more day by day than I wouldn't have really had any designs on it or anything.
That was Villagers, Conor O'Brien's the man who we were talking to there. What do we think of Villagers? I mean, this is kind of a very new album to get on. It hasn't really had time to bed in as a record, I don't think.
I think it was only out about a month before the Mercury's nominees were announced.
Amazing. What do we think of this?
Well, I know a lot of people who seem to be into it. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I mean, sort of folk, would you put it alongside the Laura Marling record, which is
not at all. I think it's got nothing in common with that. I mean, it's melancholy downbeat pop that happens to be played largely on acoustic instruments, isn't it, really?
Radically different to the Laura Marling album.
No, I think that's unfair on the Laura Marling, but we'll come to Laura Marling later, obviously.
I mean, it hasn't grabbed me particularly. I'm not sure what I'm missing.
No, it hasn't. I must admit, it sort of sailed over my head a little bit. I think that's a general...
Well, I think this might be something to do with... Yeah, we all get sent tons and tons and tons of records, and you listen to a load, and you do need something to reach out and grab you. And records like this, I think we tend to pass over because there's nothing that reaches out and grab you. I think it's one that you do need to live with.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if...
It points to a failing in music journalism.
Undoubtedly. We have to own up to it quite a lot, I think. And this is one of those records that will suffer from us not having paid enough attention.
Now it's time... So let's move on from Villagers, about whom we don't have that much to say, talk about Corinne Bailey Rae. That was Closer from Corinne Bailey Rae's album, The Sea. I'm going to open this up. I am not a man who is averse to sort of middle-of-the-road female singers. Rumour, who's around at the moment, I like her work enormously. Sounds a bit like Karen Carpenter, blah, 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 all that kind of malarkey. Corinne Bailey Rae's records, the problem I have with them is they sound like acid jazz records. They sound like the music that kind of trendy people who I was at university with who didn't actually like music at all liked. I appreciate there's a great deal of... emotional heft behind this record for obvious reasons. I appreciate that she has a lovely voice and all that kind of thing. Not my cup of tea, Rosie.
I feel as though there is, on other tracks on this album, not Close, which we just heard, but on other, there's a select few where the spiritual dimension that's been added by the fact that her husband died quite tragically. Well, it's always tragic when someone dies, but in quite unpleasant circumstances before it was made, you can really hear that it does add a spiritual dimension. Okay. And in that respect, you've got to kind of look at her in a new light, because there's something that was not even remotely there for something like Put Your Records On or that crap that she was doing before, and you suddenly get this complete, because of the kind of purity and sweetness of her, you get this real unadulterated grief in it. But it's only on some sections of the album, and it's still not, I still absolutely agree with you, it's that kind of background music that exactly as you said, people who aren't into music are quite into. For me, it's like it's in the genre of soul, and it's got absolutely no soul to it. So there are
except on
the few songs where she really lets herself go, and it's actually quite at moments quite hard to listen to because of it.
Alex,
I sort of feel the same way, really. I mean, it has kind of developed from the last album, and there is a bit of a slightly raw almost early 90s, slight grunge feel to some of them.
She used to be in a grunge band, of course.
She was in a grunge band, yeah, so I guess she's maybe going back to her roots in that. I mean, in a way, there's always been a bizarre problem with kind of sort of female soul singers that have come out of Britain. There's always been like an immediate sort of buzz, and then everybody gets bored with them, and then they seem to go straight in the middle of the road category. So in a way, I sort of applaud the Mercurys for kind of trying to encourage people to look at her in a different way as someone who's doing, you know, more kind of radical stuff. But I don't know whether the record quite stands up to that scrutiny. It is quite uneven, and some of it does lapse into kind of blandness for all the kind of terrible events that sort of inspired it and informed it.
I'm going to stick up for it. I think it's a rather lovely record, and I don't think it is kind of coffee table acid jazz. I think the one we heard is the one that cleaves most closely to that template, I think. But musically, I thought it was a lot more interesting than that. And then she's got a wonderful voice, kind of intimate and caressing. And yeah, there's the tragedy that goes with it. I actually don't think you need the tragedy to get stuff out of this record.
Well, Karine Bellie Ray, Closer, that was with the track that we listened to from her album The Sea. In with a Shout. Let's move on to the favourites for the Mercury Prize, the XX and their eponymous debut album. Before they sold thousands of records, toured the world, and became the most critically acclaimed probably album of the last year. We had them on Music Weekly. We can now hear a very timid Romy and Oliver from the band talking to Rosie. This is from about a year ago.
At what stage in the friendship did you start thinking that you might want to form a band?
It sort of just came from like a bit of a bored summer holidays. We were about 16 and I think just started getting into like listening to music and like really loving it and stuff. And I got like a little like 8-track recorder, and we just started playing around with it. Really, it was all just a bit like for fun. It was a bit of a joke.
I think it's kind of a lot easier doing more jokey stuff. A lot less embarrassing. Singing took a while. Sort of like you sing first. No, you sing first. So yes, we came to a compromise that we sing together.
Sang at the same time.
Basic space open air.
I mean, I don't know if this is at all in your minds when you're making an album, but what do you what kind of emotions or feelings do you hope that it elicits in people?
Listening to it as a whole, it's quite a transition sort of from day to night for me. Quite a lot of the sort of earlier songs, sort of like VCR, one of the first songs we wrote, it's quite a lot lighter.
Yeah, they're a bit brighter, and then as the album kind of progresses, it gets a little bit more like emotional, a little bit more like sort of heavy. But I'm not sure. It was kind of mainly written in like sort of like in the middle of the night, in just sort of kind of a weird like state of mind. When I play the music to people for the first time, I'm wondering if it's a bit heavy. Like they're suddenly like, "Oh my god, you're so like emotional." But it's kind of just like it's nice that people have been like really like okay about that, because I kind of would be a bit embarrassed sometimes.
We were just discussing the XX, who are apparently David Cameron, his wife, enjoyed listening to the XX while having a cuddle in the afternoon. We were just saying what a revolting thought that was. That was Rosie with Romy and Oliver from the XX before that terrible fate befell their record. Michael and Alex, you both think this should be the winner. I think so too. It's my favourite record of the last year by a long chalk. Why? What do you like about it?
Well, I just think it's amazing that something so kind of dry and understated has made such a big impact. Mm. But I think in a way that shows the, you know, it's just been extremely finely honed. You know, it's like the sort of sound that shatters a glass or something. It's just got a very precise emotional pitch, and it doesn't deviate that much from it throughout the whole album. But I think the cumulative effect of it is really kind of, it's just really sensational, and also it brings a sort of different voice into pop. I think it's something that we've not heard before, really.
I agree, Michael. Yeah,
they sound like no one else, and yet they don't do that by just employing sonic trickery. There are proper songs there to back it all up. I remember John Peel saying of First Hearing the Smiths that he couldn't work out what they'd been listening to, and I think that was true of the XX as well. And then when I read an interview that the main musical inspiration was Timbaland's productions in the early 90s. And you think, well, actually, yeah, that makes complete sense. I don't sound a bit like Timbaland, but that same stripped-down way of recording things. So only the things that are absolutely necessary for the songs make it to the final recording. And sometimes on Guardian blog threads, there are some readers say, oh, you know, you all just like the excess because you've all decided to. It's like some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. But I remember when the promos for this album went out, and this, obviously everyone unwrapping them on the same day and listening to them, and Twitter just full of music writers going, have you heard this XX album? It's amazing. Before we'd all had a chance to confer, because obviously we do have a hive mind eventually.
We all live in a big house together.
Yeah.
Rosie?
It's not what I want to win, just because it's not my favourite album. I think it will win. I think you know that the judges always say that there's these other factors that shouldn't have any effect on it, but I think the fact that it's the debut album by a previously unknown band is going to help. I think the fact that it's totally of its time and different enough from its contemporaries is going to help. And the fact that it's been on, you know, Hollyoaks and CSI Miami as soundtrack, but and yet still credible enough to survive, will have a huge impact on it winning. But everything Alex said is exactly why it's remained such a stunning album. But are they going to do a Gomez and just disappear?
get some guy in that sings like that.
win the Mercury and completely disappear, and then an album that people come back to a bit later and kind of go, ooh.
But I mean, this album is so kind of perfectly formed and conceived in a way. You do kind of wonder what they'd do.
Maybe they
next.
Shouldn't make another album.
Maybe not. Although it's one of them's already left, so that's bound to change the dynamic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It'd be intriguing to see what they come up next. Perfectly formed bands often don't. Bands that are perfectly formed, it's often very difficult for them to develop. Anyway, that's enough XX. Next up, it's Paul Weller. That was No Tears to Cry by Paul Weller from the album Wake Up the Nation. I really like Wake Up the Nation. I gave it 5 stars. I'm hugely impressed by the reinvention of Paul Weller as a sort of progressive and interesting artist. It was as if, having spent years boring everybody to death with his plodding man rock, he finally succeeded in boring himself and started making interesting records.
Well, I think that's exactly what happened, you know, basically. In the Film and Music interview last week, he was more or less saying that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. I just love all that kind of stuff, the notion that he's sort of really into broadcast and things like that now and is going to, you know. And also, this album contains just my favourite lyric of the last year. Them fuckers in the castles, they're all bastards too. Which is such a brilliant example of political philosophy. Anybody else? I think he could win it as well, because I think, you know, pulling something like this off when you're Paul Weller and you've been going as long as you have is quite a sort of remark. You know, it's an unexpected and remarkable thing to do. Anybody else got any thoughts?
Yeah, it's progressive for Paul Weller, but it's not necessarily that progressive without it being him. I mean, I've certainly rather listened to this than anything that he's done in the last...
And before that was good as well.
I kind of agree with Rosie. I don't think it's a great avant-garde step forward that it appears to be in the context of Paul Weller's career, but it's an amazingly enjoyable record to listen to.
It's very varied.
And it goes through different moods. You don't have a chance to get bored. And again, like the XX, it's all harnessed to really good songs as well.
It is indeed. Alex, any thoughts on Weller?
It is good all the way through. I don't know, yeah, you've got to admire the fact that he's still pushing himself. And also, you know, he's kind of, although he's changed musically, he's sort of stayed the same in a way in terms of his political outlook, in terms of what he stands for. I think he's got, you know, at one point it looked like his integrity might be being eroded by just becoming a kind of a, you know, it seemed like he was becoming
sort
very
cast
kind of
in stone,
and
yeah,
quite kind of complacent. But that seems to have gone. He seems to be reinvigorated, and you've got to admire that.
And I do like the fact that he has no time for any kind of the cant of pop stars either. Yeah. In the interview the other day, the artists who say they're making music for themselves, fuck off back to your bedroom. Yeah, quite right. You know, you're pop singers. Make records for people.
So, good old Paul Weller. Next up, it's Laura Marling and her album I Speak Because I Can. We can hear Rebecca Nicholson talking to Laura about the record, but first, here's the track Blackberry Stone.
Did I whisper that I love this man now and for forever to your soul as it floats out of the window? To the world that you turned your back on, to the world that never really let you be. And I am lower now and lower still. And you did always say that one day I would suffer.
It seems that you're singing from the perspectives of people who aren't necessarily yourself. It doesn't seem as personal as the first.
Yeah, I think more subconsciously than on the first album, everything is character based. You know, I can only write, much as I try, I can only write about myself. It's a total self indulgence songwriting, but then you can sort of hold it at arm's length and make it into a story.
There's some Greek mythology in there. Yeah, when did you get interested in that?
You have it drummed into your head from quite an early age, I think, that kind of thing. And it is fascinating how Western literature began with those stories. And society civilization, was at quite a high point around there and then took a massive dip. It's really odd, I find it really odd, took a massive dip and here we are now again. So I found, because they all of those stories have a moral or a sort of fable-ish meaning behind them, and I just think that's really they're just wonderful stories, I think.
I mean, is it a way of using these stories? Is it a way of deflecting the attention from you as a person singing in character? I guess almost.
Yeah, I think singing in character is. I definitely, not like Beyonce or anything when she gets on stage, but I definitely feel, I take on a character when I get on stage, because that is putting up a barrier. The guitar is a barrier, the microphone is a barrier, and then, the fundamental character is a barrier.
So no Sasha Fierce album from you next time.
Well, you never know.
Darkness descends.
Okay, that was Laura Marling talking to Rebecca Nicholson there. Again, I must admit, this is an album that sails completely over my head. I don't understand what the fuss is about at all. But I believe, Michael, you're prepared.
Well, I'm not a huge... To be honest, I've only come to this album the last few days preparing for this, but of all the new folk acts, Mumford & Sons, Narrow and the Whale, all those groups in that scene, Laura Marling is the one to me who seems to have the biggest connection with folk music. You know, listening to it, I'm reminded of the early Fairport and Pentangle things almost, which I know come from a different strand of folk. Alexis is grimacing here.
I just don't hear that at all. I hear a perfectly pleasant female singer.
I hear something rather beautiful, and the sound of running water. Yeah, I do think it. I think it's lovely. Because it connects to an English folk tradition, I think it's going to have more lasting worth, I think, than the other groups that have come out of that scene. And I this again is a record that's hit a profound emotional.
Yeah, I've got no
bell
definitely
a lot of people. Not so much with me, but I know people who just hear their life reflected back to them in this record, and it's not all kind of winsome 19-year-olds. And on a holiday this summer, this. Executive, I think she was at a headhunter's in her mid-40s, was going on about what an extraordinary record this was and how it made her weep. I think it appeals across a very wide range. I think Laura Marling is a real talent who will last for a long time.
Well, it didn't have that quite that effect on me, but I do find it beguiling, and there is something that I think keeps you coming back to it. And, she's a very good songwriter. She's got a beautiful voice. In terms of the English folk tradition, it's always kind of bubbled along. It's funny that she and Mumford and Sons, because she went out with. Was it Marcus she went out with?
It's Noah and the Whale fella she dumped.
Will it be a splitting up issue if one of them wins and the other doesn't?
Wow. Just imagine that. Rosie, we talked about Laura Marling.
I know,
before,
we got
we?
In a lot of trouble for
I know. You think our fans might be sort of whimsical girls in Laura Ashley Frocks, let me tell you.
I don't even think we were that rude. I think it's not an album that speaks to me. It kind of leaves me a bit cold, and I can appreciate a lot of what Michael was saying, but it doesn't reflect my life back to me, so it doesn't mean anything to me. But
good luck to her. She seems like a lovely girl.
Split down the middle. Splits the panel down the middle there, Laura Marling. Last but perhaps not least, let's discuss Fowls. That was Miami from the Foles album. Rosie, are you a Foles fan?
Well, I think that it's interesting that we should be talking on this show about albums suffering at the hands of critics who've got too much to listen to, because I think this is an album which has suffered from that for sure, and the fallout of the hype around the first record, and the fact that they were part of this kind of Battles math rock fashion from a couple of years ago, and the angularity of their music, and people kind of just say, oh no, we're distancing ourselves from that 2 years on. Whereas what they've done with the album is I wouldn't say they've completely changed their sound, but it's certainly incredibly relaxed compared to the angularity and tightness of the first record. And they themselves, you know, they do shoot themselves in the foot a bit, because they can be a bit pretentious in interviews. I remember Yanis saying, you remember the Hummer, their first song, which was kind of Devo-esque, huge pop track, and them saying, we're just not going to make an album full of that, songs like that. And you think, if they were capable of it and they could have come back with a huge pop album, that probably would have been something people paid attention to. And actually what they've done is just made a really nice, quite relaxed, laid back album and failed to capture enough people's attention.
I thought there was quite a buzz about this album when it came out. Am I wrong, Alex?
I think there was a bit of a buzz. I mean, they were on the cover of NME. Zane, I mean, it does feel like the tail end almost of something that had gone on for quite a long time. Mm. Anyway, which is sort of indie bands influenced by post-punk stuff. I mean, they have moved it on a bit, but I don't find anything that compelling about them. I don't know what they stand for, really, Foles, beyond the sort of where a bit math rock and arty. Mm. I just don't. There's something quite diffident about them.
Well, there is a bit more emotion to that album, I would say, this one compared to the first one. There's obviously been a bit of heartbreak in the last couple of years, and you can really, there's some real like swelling ballads, but you just didn't get that on the first album.
Yanis was interviewed by Dave Simpson for Film and Music, and I mean, he was opening his heart about the difficult times he's had, and so I think there is a strong emotionality to this album, but you know, as with others around the table, it didn't really do a whole lot for me. Although, you know, Dave, sorry to keep referring to Dave, but on the albums that he really has paid close attention to. But, you know, he swears by this album. He's also saying they're an extraordinary live band at the moment.
Wow, I've never seen them live. I would like to check them out. That concludes, ladies and gentlemen, our discussion on the 12 nominees. Before we go, we've heard who you'd like to win. Tell me who you think will win. Rosie?
I think the XX will get it.
Alex?
I would have said Biffy Clyro, but I was talking to someone this morning who's in their camp, and he said no chance. So
near chance. No. Michael? You haven't actually answered the who do you see?
But I might still keep with Biffy Clyro.
Okay, keep Biffy Clyro. Michael?
I think it's a three-way thing between the XX, Laura Marling, and Corinne Bailey-Ray.
I think it may be between the XX and Paul Weller. And possibly Laura Marling.
I think there are 11 strong contenders.
You know, I think anybody could win. Fucking Kit Downs trio are going to win. I think probably the XX.
Okay, if I'm pegged down to one, I think probably the XX, unless the judges decide to be contrary.
Well, we shall find out. Thank you very much for coming in, Michael and Alex. Always a pleasure. Rosie, always a pleasure to see you. Cheers to our producer, Pete. I'm Alexis Petridis, and Music Weekly will be back next Friday. Hope you can join us then. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.